In the quiet town of Fairhill, Vermont, where everyone knows everyone, a gruesome discovery tears through the peaceful facade. Farmer Roy Ressler stumbles upon the naked body of 17-year-old Diana Brewer lying in his field, her stomach ripped open by scavenging birds, her eyes gouged out. The purple bruising around her throat tells a clear story: strangulation. Within hours, the news ripples through the community like a shockwave. At Fairhill High School, a classroom falls silent as officials appear with grim expressions. Meanwhile, Brenda Brewer, a night shift nurse and single mother, returns home to find Police Chief Hall waiting with news that will destroy her world. What makes this discovery particularly chilling isn't just the violence itself, but the realization that in a community where neighbors trust neighbors, someone among them is a killer. The body wasn't just discarded, it was deliberately displayed, suggesting not just murder, but a disturbing message. As investigators swarm Roy's field, a haunting question emerges: what kind of person would leave a young girl for the birds? The investigation centers on three key suspects with incriminating secrets. Cameron Farrell, Diana's boyfriend, becomes the prime suspect when his alibi collapses. Though he claimed to have dropped Diana home before 11, his mother caught him returning at 1:11 a.m. When confronted, he admits going back to Diana's after she broke up with him, refusing to attend the same college, his possessiveness and rejection providing a potential motive. Joe Pryor, a creepy regular customer at Diana's Home Depot workplace, always chose her checkout line and paid only in cash. The large, scruffy, bearded man claims he was merely being friendly, but suspiciously refuses to let police search his truck. The third suspect is gym teacher Brad Turner, against whom Diana had filed a complaint for inappropriate behavior. Principal Kelly had dismissed it, but another girl has since made similar allegations. Turner's engagement to Roy Ressler's daughter Ellen creates a troubling connection to the crime scene. Diana's murder transforms Fairhill overnight. Once unlocked doors are now double-checked, free-roaming children kept indoors. Every stranger becomes a potential threat, every neighbor a possible suspect. The ripple effects reveal the fragility of small-town trust. Brenda Brewer wanders her empty house consumed by grief, feeling her daughter's presence. She blames herself for not being home that night, convinced she might have prevented Diana's death if she hadn't switched shifts. The Farrell family fractures under suspicion, with Cameron isolating himself as his parents debate whether to help him destroy evidence. Ellen Ressler watches her future crumble amid allegations against her fiancé Brad. Torn between loyalty and doubt, especially after learning of multiple accusers, Ellen begins questioning everything when Brad coaches her on what to tell police. At Fairhill High, English teacher Paula Acosta worries about her students processing the tragedy and her own daughter's safety. When Taylor confides she too experienced inappropriate behavior from Mr. Turner, Paula realizes his predatory behavior may be more widespread than anyone suspected. One of the most haunting aspects of the narrative is Diana's continued presence as an unseen witness to the investigation. Though dead, her consciousness lingers, observing the aftermath with growing clarity. Initially confused, she watches her mother's grief, her friend's pain, and the police investigation with dreamlike distance, unable to recall what happened. "I see my mother weeping, her face contorted with grief," she observes, "and there's nothing I can do to comfort her." As the investigation progresses, Diana's memories gradually return. She remembers Joe Pryor's distinctive odor from Home Depot appearing in her car one night. She recalls Brad Turner's threats when she reported his inappropriate behavior. Yet the full memory of her murder remains frustratingly elusive. This supernatural element connects to the town's folklore tradition. Diana's friend Riley recalls a ghost story about Emily, who haunts a covered bridge after her suicide. The story gains significance as Riley worries Diana might be similarly trapped between worlds until justice is served. The case takes a dramatic turn when Riley receives a text response from Diana's missing phone, "No, you won't," after sending a message about finding the killer. Detective Stone recognizes this as the killer's first mistake, believing they kept the phone as a trophy. This development leads to increased police protection for Riley and intensified scrutiny of all suspects. Meanwhile, Joe Pryor is arrested, not for Diana's murder, but for killing Katie Cantor in upstate New York 2 years earlier. Brad Turner is also arrested after Principal Kelly finally reveals everything Diana told him, that Brad entered her house uninvited, frightened her, made her undress, and threatened her the night before she died. With both Pryor and Turner in custody, it appears the case might be solved. But the day after Diana's funeral, Riley visits her friend Evan, still troubled despite the arrests. She questions whether police arrested the right person. When Riley retreats to Evan's bedroom to rest, she makes a shocking discovery under his bed: Diana's distinctive red sparkly phone case. Diana's ghost finally remembers her death. After her breakup with Cameron, Evan visited, supposedly to retrieve a book. When she mentioned the breakup, Evan confessed his love. Uncomfortable, Diana laughed nervously, a fatal mistake. Enraged at perceived ridicule, Evan struck her with his copy of Moby Dick, then strangled her with her jump rope as she lay helpless. Riley, realizing her friend Evan is the killer, discreetly calls 911 while he's downstairs. When Evan discovers her in his room and checks her call history, his expression transforms to rage just as police sirens approach. Evan, the quiet, bookish friend who had been helping Brenda through grief and supporting Riley's investigation, was the murderer all along. His journal entries, seemingly thoughtful reflections of a young man processing tragedy, were elaborate fictions, a performance of who he wanted to be, rather than who he truly was. What makes Evan's character chilling is how his murderous rage emerged from rejection rather than calculation. His unrequited love for Diana, once ridiculed, triggered a violent transformation from friend to killer. His copy of Moby Dick becoming the murder weapon symbolizes how his intellectual identity became an instrument of violence when his ego was wounded. After the initial violence, Evan became calculating, staging the crime scene, disposing of Diana's body, and manipulating her loved ones during the investigation. Yet he couldn't part with her phone, the trophy that ultimately led to its capture. Evan's final reflections show a disturbing lack of remorse. He thinks pragmatically about legal strategies and potential sentences, even considering how notoriety might benefit his writing career. "Prison might actually help my writing," he muses, "give me some life experience." This detachment highlights the novel's exploration of unexpected darkness in seemingly normal people. Isn't this the most terrifying truth? That monsters aren't strangers lurking in shadows, but people sitting across from us at dinner, helping through grief, sharing intimate moments? Perhaps Fairhill's real lesson is that we never truly know anyone completely. Not our neighbors, friends, or even ourselves.